content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine, dated November 10, 2025. The front cover, as usual, is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is in large white block capital letters, but it's hard to read because it's superimposed upon a very busy background. The caption for the magazine cover says Trump's World, and that's in bright white, which is easier to read than the Time, which is kind of, I'm going to say, smeared into this busy background of gold draperies, a green tree in the background, several flags, including the United States Navy, the United States Marine Corps, the U.S. American flag, and one more, which is not indicative in this photograph. President Trump is seated at the desk, front and center, and presumably this is the Oval Office, but it is not stated as such. Moving to the contents then, the brief news. First, a photograph. It's nearly half a page in size, and it's in color, brilliantly colored. And the caption is Church and State. Pope Leo XIV stands with the UK's King Charles III and Queen Camilla in front of Apostolic Palace in Vatican City, October 23. During the state visit, the King, who is Supreme Governor of the Church of England, prayed with the Pontiff, marking the first time a British monarch has done so in nearly 500 years, since King Henry VIII broke away from the Catholic Church. The very colorful aspect of this is a row of Swiss guards decked out in their traditional, I believe it's medieval or Renaissance era, apparel of bright blue, yellow, gold, and red. These are widely striped fabric that make up the uniform or garb of the French guards. They're also wearing black helmets with very large fluffy red feathers on the top. Now, we see only the backs of them because they're between the camera and the principals noted in the caption. Left to right, Queen Camilla in her elegant but simply cut black dress, a black hosiery, black pumps. She's carrying a black purse. She's also wearing what is what may be described as a mantilla. It's net flowing from her head down to her back, but it's held in place by something that looks not so much like a comb, but like a feathery holder for this elegant veil. Next, we see the Pope, Pope Leo XIV, and he is also in liturgical vestment. This is very colorful. It's white on the main. Oh, I'm going to say cassock. I'm not sure it's a cassock. And then he has another surplice in white. And then he has a bright red cape, and then over that is the stole of his priestly office, and that stole is heavily embroidered in gold. It looks different colors from one side to the other, and I don't know if that's just because of the lighting, but it looks like a very dark, vibrant red, turning to an even darker purple. But again, it's heavily embroidered with gold. His crucifix is gold, hanging from around his neck, and he wears the white monk's cap or in this case, pontiff's cap. Then next to him is King Charles, and he is outfitted in a rather bright royal blue suit, white shirt, and it looks like a silvery gray tie. It's interesting to describe these two gentlemen, Leo and Charles, because they look to be about the same size. They are not looking at the camera, and there are other people surrounding them, mostly cardinals, I think, based upon their black and red attire. And another Swiss guard stands next to King Charles. And I can tell you that the jackets are very closely fitted in this uniform, or the jacket is, and then they're almost like pantaloons. The pants are wide and then tight at the knee, and then there are leggings that extend down to the shoes. And this man is wearing, again, that black helmet with the fluffy red feather and holding a lance that is, goodness, it must be at least 12 feet tall. Then the rest of this page is filled with an article that says the bulletin, how thieves carried out an audacious heist at the Louvre, by Rebecca Schneid and Solcira Borga. A brazen daylight heist left the Louvre Museum in Paris reeling October 19. It took just a few minutes for thieves to execute the robbery, coming away with jewels worth an estimated 88 million euros, once belonging to Napoleon and his empresses. The police investigation remains ongoing. French newspaper Le Parisien reported two of the four thieves, masked and hooded, entered the museum via the Seine-facing facade around 9:30 a.m. Construction work aided their heist, as a cherry picker allowed them to access the Apollo Gallery jewel room directly. French Interior Minister Laurent Nunez said the raid lasted just 7 minutes. The robbers reportedly escaped on scooters. A crown of the Empress Eugenie was recovered damaged, apparently dropped by the thieves in their haste to escape. Now that crown is pictured. It's just a small photo, but it's just looks like a lot of gold and a lot of jewels. And at the top of the crown, there's an orb and a cross on top of the orb, and they appear to be in diamonds and emeralds, but I'm only saying that based upon the coloration of the jewels I can see. The Louvre has faced persistent staffing issues in recent months, with employee strikes closing the museum for hours this summer after workers raised concerns about overcrowding and mass tourism. In 2023, the museum decided to limit visitors to just 30,000 per day. Although it is unclear whether staffing issues contributed to the theft, unions stated in June workers were still under immense pressure, with too few eyes on too many entrances. This was not the first high-profile heist at the Louvre. In 1911, a former employee, Vincenzo Perugia, stole the famous Mona Lisa in hopes of returning it to its original country of Italy. At the time, Leonardo da Vinci's masterpiece was not the world-renowned painting it is today, but the theft helped it grow in fame. More than 2 years after the theft, Perugia attempted to sell the painting in Florence, which was when he was caught and the Mona Lisa was returned. The brief news, good question, why do health insurance costs keep rising, by Alana Samuels. Jacob McDonald knows he is lucky to have a good health insurance plan through his employer, a tech company. But when his company recently updated employees about their options for health care in 2026, he was disappointed to learn that once again, costs were going up. To cover his family of four, McDonald, 47, a network engineer based in Dallas, is being asked to pay 6.5% more than he he did last year toward health insurance. I expected to pay more, but this is the largest increase I can remember, he says. Ballooning health care costs are driving up the price of insurance for the 154 million Americans who rely on employer-sponsored coverage. Starting this month and into January, employees will be able to pick their plans for the next year during the open enrollment process and get a sense of just how much more they will pay. One recent survey by Mercer found employers expect to pay an average of 6.5% more for health care for their employees in 2026, which is the highest increase since 2010. Another poll of employers by the Business Group on Health found that respondents projected health care costs to jump 7.6% in 2026 on average, the highest increase in over a decade. The rise in health care costs also affects people who do not have health insurance through an employer, an issue that accounts for the government shutdown that began October 1. Democrats and Republicans are at odds over extending subsidies that reduced premiums for Affordable Care Act, ACA, plans starting in 2021. Without the subsidies, which Democrats favor, ACA premiums will rise by an average of 75% in 2026. While health care costs typically grow every year, the past few years have seen a steep increase in prices, according to Mercer. After a decade in which growth hovered around 3% annually, 2026 is the fourth year in a row where costs surpass that mark. A few factors are driving the cost surge. Inflation is the most obvious. Sunit Patel, senior partner and chief U.S. health actuary of Mercer, notes that overall inflation in the economy takes a while to work itself into the healthcare system. But doctors are charging more this year than they were last year, in part because of those inflationary pressures. And labor costs at those doctors' offices and at hospitals are rising, says Matthew Ray, the associate director of the program on the healthcare marketplace at KFF, a healthcare research organization. At the same time, people are making greater use of doctors and hospitals. After a few pandemic years in which they stayed away from places where sick people gathered, insured employees are also using GLP-1s, which are extremely costly to lose weight and stay healthy. A combination of things puts pressure on premiums, plus 6% to 7% is a meaningful increase, says Ray. KFF released a survey of 1,800 employers in October that found an employee's share of premiums to cover a family of four in 2025 reached $6,850. That is up 6% from a year before, while wages grew 4% during that time. Employers are feeling the pain as well because workers pay only a quarter of a premium that all told, reached almost $27,000. As a result, many are asking employees to pay more. The average deductible that employees paid in 2025, $1,886, has increased 17% over the past 5 years and 43% over the past 10 years. The rising costs are forcing some employers to make difficult decisions. If they absorb the expenses to protect their employees, they may have to make cuts in other parts of the business. If they pass the price increases on to employees, they might face pushback. Indeed, after most employers get first quotes from health insurance companies on costs, they negotiate, eliminating some benefits or plan choices to bring costs down. Without those negotiations, for instance, Mercer estimates plan costs would grow 9% in 2026 rather than 6.5%. This year we'll see 59% of employers making cost-cutting changes to their plans, according to Mercer, up from 48% making changes in 2025 and 44% in 2024. That could include no longer covering GLP-1 drugs or raising deductibles and out-of-pocket maximums. Employees will probably stick around for most people, even with the increased costs. A health insurance plan through their employer is the best deal they are going to find. Milestones is next. It's one page with two longer articles and four thumbnail sketches. The first long article, Died, Diane Keaton, Actor Extraordinaire. This is by Stephanie Zakarik. For those of us who measure our lives in movies, actors are not just performers who've given us joy. They are people who've walked along with us year by year. To watch ourselves age is not much fun, but to watch them age is the privilege of a lifetime. That is how it was with Diane Keaton, who died October 11 at age 79. She was so many things, a wonderful photographer, a fine director, an individual of marvelously expressive personal style, but mostly she was one of the most sparkling and versatile actors of her generation, one who took full advantage of the freedom newly afforded to actresses in the 1970s. Even as the men of the new Hollywood, performers like Robert De Niro and Al Pacino, one of Keaton's great loves, drew louder praise. Keaton landed her first major film role in 1972 opposite Pacino in The Godfather. She is heartrending as Michael Corleone's wife, Kay, ready to be a dutiful wife and mother, only to be shut out of her husband's orbit. Her career thrived in the 1980s and beyond. She is staggering as an abandoned wife in the end of a marriage drama, Shoot the Moon. And in the 1990s and 2000s, she was often the best thing about comedies like Something's Gotta Give. In 1995, she made her fiction feature directorial debut with the freewheeling, briskly sweet picture, Unstrung Heroes. Through it all, Keaton has always felt like a person we knew, largely because of the role her then-boyfriend Woody Allen wrote specially for her, the title character of 1977's Annie Hall. As the one-time girlfriend of Allen's preternaturally neurotic comedian, Alvie Singer, Keaton breezes through like a gust of autumn wind. She's as captivating and capricious as a curlicue of airborne leaves. Nonchalant and focused at once, that was Keaton, inviting us along on a path of adventurous curves and turns, one whose length we would never think to measure till we looked back and saw how far we'd come. And again, Died, D'Angelo, Soul Genius. This is by Andrew R. Chow. The R&B singer D'Angelo, who died October 14 at the age of 51, forged countless moments of artistic brilliance over his three-decade career. He was an electric live performer who perfected multiple instruments, as well as a studio wizard who crafted three near-perfect albums, Brown Sugar, 1995, Voodoo, which Time named Best of 2000, and which included the classic song Untitled, How Does It Feel?, and Black Messiah, 2014. D'Angelo's distilled musings about sex, suffering, love, and oppression into musical masterpieces, but he also struggled in his personal life, wrestling with alcoholism, drug abuse, and anxiety. His family said he died after a prolonged battle with cancer. And again, Died, Ace Frehley, a founding member and lead guitarist of the glam rock band Kiss, October 16 at 74. Fraley, who designed the group's iconic logo, was known for using pyrotechnic effects on his guitars. Demolished the east wing of the White House, as ordered by President Donald Trump, to make way for a 90,000-square-foot ballroom that is estimated to cost between $200 million and $300 million. Relinquished his titles by Britain's Prince Andrew October 17, amid scrutiny over his ties to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Continued accusations about me distract from the work of the royal family, he said. And released former Republican Representative George Santos of New York from prison October 17, after President Trump commuted his seven-year fraud sentence. Santos served less than 3 months. Turning the page to the brief 2030, that's 2030, Innovation, the Promise of Nuclear Fusion Power, by Harry Booth, with reporting by Billy Perigo. When Sam Altman arrived at Helion Energy's small Redmond, Washington office in early 2014, nuclear fusion textbooks tucked under his arm, the company was focusing its efforts on research and development. But by the time he left several days later, he had persuaded the fusion energy startup to chart a more aggressive path toward deployment, CEO David Kirtley recalls. A year later, Altman, who was co-founding OpenAI around the same time, invested $9.5 million in Helion, taking the role of chairman. He plowed a further $375 million into Helion in 2021, making it one of the largest personal bets in his multi-billion dollar portfolio. Once a government-led pursuit, nuclear fusion is now a private capital race, much of it financed by the same people building energy-hungry AI and pursuing the goal of creating systems with human-like intelligence, known as artificial general intelligence, AGI. The fusion energy industry's total funding has jumped from $1.7 billion in 2020 to $15 billion as of September 2025, according to a report by EU body Fusion for Energy. Alongside Altman, who has said AI's future depends on an energy breakthrough, investors in Helion include OpenAI funder SoftBank, as well as Facebook co-founder and early Anthropic backer Dustin Moskovitz. NVIDIA has backed Helion rival Commonwealth Fusion Systems, CFS. So too has Google, which has also invested in another player, TAE Technologies. AI is a big driver due to the energy needs to power their data centers, says Troy Carter, director of Oak Ridge National Laboratory's Fusion Energy Division. Recent engineering progress and the flood of cash from investors willing to chase moonshots have some firms promising grid power within years rather than decades. They must still prove the technology works, but if fusion delivers, it would provide carbon-free power without solar and winds, seasonal fluctuation, or nuclear fission's long-lived radioactive waste, a breakthrough that would not just lower power bills, but reshape what is possible. Fusion, the same reaction that powers the sun, makes energy via the opposite process of today's nuclear power plants, joining light atoms rather than splitting heavier ones. Deep in a star's core, this occurs in plasma, a super-hot, electrically charged gas. Recreating that on Earth has proved the mother of all engineering problems. For decades, even as scientists were able to spark a fusion reaction, it generated less energy than required to heat the plasma, known as scientific break-even. But in 2022, researchers at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory made history using giant lasers to briefly crush a tiny fuel pellet. They demonstrated for the first time a fusion reaction that generated more energy than was used to heat the plasma. No private company has hit this milestone. If or when they do, getting power onto the grid will require going a step further, generating not just more energy than was used to heat the plasma, but enough to power the entire generator, known as engineering break-even. Of the firms racing to hit that milestone, Helion is running to the most bullish schedule. The company expects a commercial version of its machine to provide electricity by 2028 from a site in Malaga, Washington, where construction began in July. Helion has already signed a deal to sell 50 megawatts of fusion power to Microsoft and faces financial penalties if it veers from its timeline. Unlike most fusion efforts, which boil water to spin a turbine, Helion plans to harvest electricity by hurling two plasma rings together at about a million miles an hour. The collision would trigger fusion, perturbing a magnetic field, which in turn produces power. Kirtley says the setup currently recaptures about 76% of its energy input, sort of like how an EV uses regenerative braking to recharge a bit during a trip. That puts it within a hair of break-even already. Polaris, Helion's seventh-generation prototype, was slated to demonstrate engineering break-even in 2024. The prototype was fired up for the first time late that year. Kirtley declined to share results. Kirtley, who credits Altman with encouraging him to go faster and at bigger scale, envisions not only being first to build a fusion plant. Our goal is to build a generator per day and deploy fusion systems all over the world and do that quickly. That kind of ambitious thinking has credibly brought fusion's arrival closer, Oak Ridge's Carter says. In 2020, he led a Department of Energy report that said a pilot nuclear fusion plant could be built by the early 2040s, but he now thinks it's possible that goal could be achieved by the mid-2030s. And beyond capital, AI is a useful tool for scientific progress. The advent of AI has made some very challenging problems in the plasma space more accessible, says Nuno Loureiro, director of MIT's Plasma Science and Fusion Center. Even if Helion's plan were to run a few years behind schedule, it could still hit many world firsts. And if its approach does not pan out, others are lining up right behind it. California-based startup Pacific Fusion says it has designed a machine that would hit engineering break-even using the same approach as the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory's device. It launched in 2024, revealing $900 million from investors, including Google CEO Eric Schmidt and Microsoft AI CEO Mustafa Suleiman. CFS, which spun out of MIT in 2018 to become the best-funded fusion startup, is pursuing a different approach, creating a magnetic bottle that holds an ultra-hot plasma in place. CFS is building a pilot that it believes will pass scientific break-even in 2027. The company is so bullish it's begun work in parallel on a commercial plant that it expects to deliver that energy to the grid in the early 2030s. Google's already agreed to buy 200 megawatts. Having these big hyperscalers behind us is really helpful, says Brandon Sorbaum, CFS's co-founder and chief science officer, adding it signals to suppliers who provide superconducting magnets and other difficult-to-manufacture materials that this is not a one-off science experiment. Meanwhile, New Zealand-based upstart OpenStar generated plasma in late 2024 with a relatively modest $10 million in funding and has since raised a further $14 million. Its prototype flips the magnetic bottle concept in an inside-out with an ultra-strong magnet at the core of the reactor around which the plasma is confined. While optimistic about the number of startups vying to become industry leaders, Carter warns that a high-profile failure could spook investors and dent the field's credibility. You hope the hype does not get too much, that a failure of one of the more visible companies does not pull the plug on progress that we have elsewhere, he says. Still, fusion cannot come fast enough for the likes of Google and Microsoft. Both are building new data centers to power AI, even as Microsoft targets being carbon negative by 2030, and Google targets net zero. The data centers powering AIs run 24/7. Without an energy storage breakthrough, variable wind and solar will not reliably cover that load. And supply is tight. U.S. power generation has barely budged since 2010, the year it was overtaken by China as the world's largest electricity producer. Even fossil fuel might struggle to scale as compute soars. Altman and NVIDIA's Jensen Huang now call energy the key bottleneck. But unlocking fusion power will have repercussions far beyond powering data centers. It could be built where energy is needed rather than where wind or solar conditions are best. And with abundant energy, global economic and geopolitical dynamics could be turned on their head. Most of our wars are fought over energy, Carter says. If that is no longer the driver, that changes things dramatically. Turning the page to the brief health. Five things therapists wish every kid knew. That's K-N-E-W. You never know what's going to stick in the littlest minds. Sometimes I'll have kids tell me something their grandmother or coach said, and it might be something the rest of us would shrug off, but for the child, it really made an impact, says Amy Morin, a therapist and author of 13 Things Strong Kids Do. That's why it's important for parents to get into the habit of repeating the nuggets of wisdom they hope will become mantras bouncing around in the kids' minds for years to come. We asked Morin and other therapists to share the easy-to-remember gems they wish every kid knew. 1. Listen to your shoulder angel. When Morin talks to kids, she explains that we all have a devil on one shoulder, telling us to do things that might feel good in the moment but are not the best choice, and an angel on the other, telling us to do the right thing. Those are the two voices you hear in your head when mom says, "Don't eat the cookie," and the little devil says, "No, grab it," and your shoulder angel is saying, "No, you really shouldn't." She says, you have the power to decide which one you are going to listen to. That memorable image can communicate a valuable lesson about how good it feels to be able to make a positive choice, which in turn can boost kids' confidence and independence. 2. Mean people are just showing how they feel about themselves. If someone's bullying you, Morin tells her youngest clients, It is because they feel bad about themselves. It is so important for kids to know that if you felt good about yourself, you would be kind to other people, she says. Mean people's words and behaviors are a reflection of what is going on inside of them, not you. That is not an excuse for bullies' hurtful behavior, she adds, but it does invite empathy. Ideally, kids will start to think, okay, there is something else going on with this person that I do not know about, Morin says. And then they will not take that name-calling or those mean words quite so personally. 3. Asking for help is a kind of bravery. Certainly, independence is important, but kids don't need to figure everything out on their own, and learning that it is okay to ask for help is a lifelong skill. It is vulnerable, for sure, and I think that's why people don't always do it, says Naveen Kalfan, a licensed marriage and family therapist at Headspace, but vulnerability is a strength. 4. Just because you have a thought doesn't make it true. It is okay to question your brain, and in fact, it is a good idea to get in the habit of noticing and challenging negative thoughts. We have this idea that if we're thinking something, we have to pay attention to it, and that there's meaning there, says Natalie Bernstein, a psychologist in Pittsburgh. That is not necessarily the case. Instead, approach that thought with curiosity, she advises kids. Be an investigator. Don't just take it as a fact. Look into it a little bit. And 5, you are loved for who you are, not what you do. In this achievement-oriented world, when kids are overscheduled with extras, like private lessons and multiple competitive leagues, it is easy to equate success with worthiness. Validation can feel like it's only coming through their performance on the sports team, Bernstein says. But what happens if you decide you want to quit softball or do not have a good game? It is important to start learning at an early age that your parents are not there because they are thinking you're going to hit a home run, she says. They're there because they want to support you and you like the sport. The sooner that message becomes imprinted on a kid's brain, the less likely they are to lean into the anxiety and perfectionism that could chase them for a lifetime. The View, Society, Machine Loving by Maisha Battle, who is a certified clinical sexologist and sex and dating coach, educator, and speaker. Many modern relationships start with a phone notification, a text from the stranger from last night, a delightful chime that you're a match, a haptic vibrating your hand. Daters are using ChatGPT and Claude to craft their profiles and witty messages. People are even skipping human dating altogether in favor of AI. It is fair to say our romantic relationships are becoming dependent on our use of technology. The term digisexual was coined in 2017 to identify those whose primary sexual experiences are mediated by technology, meaning they prefer tech-based sex as opposed to flesh-based sex. By that definition, there's a growing number of digisexuals out in the dating scene. According to a 2023 Pew Research Center report, 30% of U.S. adults and 53% under the age of 30 have used a dating site or app. Interestingly, only 10% of partnered people polled met in this way. That means that many daters who use apps are engaging with this technology without seeing the results they signed up for. Of course, not everyone wants a relationship, but according to surveys conducted by Tinder, the most used dating app in the country, the majority of daters do. As a result, many daters are frustrated by their relationships with the apps. In fact, those relationships are often the only ones they get from dating online. Another phenomena I am seeing more and more often is people who would rather text, video call, and engage with their matches through social media than ever meet in person. Only after weeks, months, or sometimes over a year of tech-based communication will some of my clients realize they should meet their connection in person. Technological encroachment on your love life does not end with dating. We use technology to keep in touch, plan dates, send romantic missives, and sext. There are apps designed to help you build a bond by asking you and your partner about yourselves and sharing your responses. Some apps help you learn the best ways to please yourself and your partner in bed, while others promise deeper conversations through helpful prompts. There are apps for chore wheels, therapy, mindfulness, relationship coaching, and pretty much anything else you need help with. We even use tech as a way to judge compatibility. I've had clients who really struggled with how the person they were dating communicated with them digitally. In fact, it's a common complaint that face-to-face interactions are great, but the person's texting style or pace of communicating digitally is less than ideal. In some cases, this mismatch was enough for the relationship to end. In others, it was cause for conversations and either a compromise or acceptance. And then there's technology we use for our intimate lives. Sending nudes that disappear is an option on several messaging apps. And if you want to know what you and your partner have in common sexually, there's an app for that too. A quarter of young adults believe AI has the potential to replace human romantic relationships, according to the Institute for Family Studies. Of the people most in favor of AI relationships, heavy porn users are at the top. We're already seeing how chatbots that were not designed for this purpose are being used as romantic partners. Several AI companies have sprung up to meet the demand for AI partners, and on October 14, OpenAI announced that ChatGPT is getting in on the game. Starting in December, CEO Sam Altman said in a post on X, as part of our treat adult users like adults principle, we will allow even more, like erotica, for verified adults. But tech-based solutions that completely smooth out the necessary friction of living and growing through the natural course of a relationship are not a sustainable solution for society's romantic frustrations. So much of the benefits of partnership come from moments of disagreement and conflict resolution. That's when you learn the most about yourself and your partner. Most AI chatbots are made to be agreeable and cater to your every need, which is not how typical romantic partnerships work. So many of us believed that technology could enrich our lives, but never thought it would take up so much space in our relationships. Arriving at our digisexual reality has been a slippery slope from app to bot that we never saw coming. Now that awareness of these trends is on the rise, will we consciously allow technology to continue to shape our relationships? And will the next wave of tech make us even more dependent on it for love? Again, that was written by Meisha Battle. Inbox in the Loop by Andrew R. Chow, tech correspondent. In October, heart-wrenching photos of a 12-year-old girl driving her sick puppy to the vet went viral on social media. But upon closer examination, users noticed strange details. Her steering wheel was on the right side of the car, which also lacked a dashboard. The image, perhaps predictably, was another example of AI slop, artificial content designed for no reason other than maximum engagement on social media. An increasing amount of AI slop is now churning through social media thanks to the arrival of Sora 2, S-O-R-A space 2, OpenAI's new text-to-video model. The tool, which quickly shot to the top of the App Store, allows users to describe a scene and then renders it within seconds. While OpenAI CEO Sam Altman hopes the videos will feel fun and new, critics see them as a potential death knell for social media. What was supposed to be a revolutionary medium for maintaining friendships and relationships has now become a fake content generation machine, where it's impossible to tell what is and is not real. The irony is that AI might end up saving human connection because they're making us so desperate for the real thing, says Kashyap Rajesh, a vice president at the youth-led organization ENCODE. Realistic AI-generated images are video, and videos are a major goal for every major AI lab. AI leaders hope users will be able to create music videos, movies, and advertisements quickly and cheaply, spurring a new age of creativity. Some also believe video models are the key to ushering in artificial general intelligence, or AGI, that understands physics perfectly and thus can move seamlessly through the world. In order to hone their models, these companies need users to create large amounts of content that can be used for training data. This year alone, Meta has released a dedicated AI video feed called Vibes, Google released VO3, and ByteDance released C-Dance, that's S-E-E Dance. These apps can be viewed as part of a larger flywheel. Mainstream usage simultaneously improves the products. As a result, many users are now enjoying AI videos of talking gnomes or Tupac Shakur boxing the Pope. But Rajesh argues realistic AI videos will threaten our shared understanding of reality and make it extremely cheap and easy to run disinformation and misinformation campaigns. While Sora videos come with watermarks signifying their provenance, tools have already been created to either add or remove them, sowing confusion. It kind of creates this low-level paranoia within people that kills the spontaneity and magic of social media. To begin with, Rajesh says. Ben Coleman, CEO of Reality Defender, conducted a security experiment and found he was able to use Sora to forge AI impersonations of prominent people, then authenticate them as if they originated from the celebrities themselves. He also worries AI will exacerbate divisive content. The platforms are effectively marketplaces for attention, he says. It creates this infinitely more polarizing echo chamber of giving mass market consumers what they need to become more extreme in all things. Some people are growing so disenchanted they're renouncing their phones altogether. Earlier this year, educator Grant Besner co-organized a program in D.C. called Month Offline, in which participants are encouraged to turn off their smartphones for a month and interrogate their relationships with the devices they have become addicted to. He says Sora 2 and hyper-realistic video may be the breaking point where humans kind of reclaim some of their agency and say, you know what, this whole frictionless way of relating to information and to each other and to ourselves maybe isn't producing better outcomes. The View World, the Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, contributing editor. When former Prime Minister, champion of multi-party democracy, and longtime opposition leader Raila Odinga died October 15, Kenya lost the country's most consequential figure of the past generation. Odinga, who served prison time for his steadfast support for democracy and political reform, played a critical role in replacing a colonial-era charter with the country's current constitution, which imposes clearer limits on presidential power. He ran for president and lost five times, but in the 2022 election, he won the majority of the vote in all but two regions, thanks to his ability to build a strong following outside his regional and Luo ethnic base. Odinga was not just a star of the past. His ability to hold the loyalty of one of Kenya's largest and most diverse voting blocs, to unify the opposition Orange Democratic Movement, ODM, a center-left outfit, and to organize protests and use them to win concessions from government, kept him a central political player. Odinga's recent coalition with President William Ruto bolstered Kenya's political stability at times when a return to the political violence of the past seemed possible, and his death now leaves Ruto in a much more vulnerable position. The ODM holds the second largest share of seats in Kenya's parliament, and Odinga was the leader who decided most of the party's policy positions on legislative issues. Ruto needed Odinga's control of these votes to advance his agenda. Ruto responded to Odinga's death by declaring a 7-day period of mourning and deep reflection in honor of Odinga's extraordinary contribution to our nation. Odinga's death leaves a large political vacuum. He had led the ODM since its creation in 2005 and had served as the party's presidential candidate in every general election it contested. But senior members of the ODM opposed his alliance with Ruto, even as they joined his broad-based cabinet, and continued to criticize the president despite the coalition. Many party leaders argued openly Ruto's flagging popularity gave the ODM a rare opportunity to peel away some of Ruto's backers, but Odinga managed to keep the coalition intact. Younger ODM members who helped organize last year's Gen Z protests, some of the biggest anti-government demonstrations since democracy was restored in the 1990s, denounced Odinga's cooperation with Ruto as an act of political betrayal. These youth protesters oppose the Ruto government's over living standards, often blatant government corruption, and its heavy hand toward demonstrators. Odinga's passing has opened the door to intense debate within the ODM over whether, when, and how the party might abandon Ruto ahead of Kenya's 2027 presidential election. October 16, the party chose Odinga's 82-year-old brother as its interim leader, but no single figure within the ODM looks able to unite its members around a strong legislative and political strategy. It is not just the ODM's way forward that remains unclear. Would-be presidents across the country know that success in the 2027 election will depend on winning over Odinga's supporters. Ruto hoped Odinga's endorsement of him to serve another 5-year term would help him lock down re-election in 2027. And opposition leaders had tried to pull Odinga into their camps. Unfortunately for all, the lack of any unifying figure within the ODM could simply fragment Odinga's base as a bitter leadership fight within the party divides it into factions. The good news for Kenya is that at least in the near term, the dangerous political unrest we have seen in the past remains unlikely. Following a funeral in Odinga's home region, tensions will run high, but even in a country where police brutality remains a hot political issue, Ruto's need to keep the ODM within the governing coalition for as long as he can reduces the threat that confrontations between police and mourners will turn violent. Still, Kenya's longer-term political outlook just got a lot murkier as the scramble to win over Odinga supporters will intensify in the months ahead. With so many governments today led by strong men or would-be strong men in Africa and beyond, Odinga's passing is a landmark loss. There's a photo here of Odinga, and who joined forces with Kenyan President Ruto. Both men are pictured here. Odinga's dressed plainly. It almost looks like a uniform. It's a dark brown long-sleeved shirt that overlays the same dark brown trousers. The two men are shaking hands. President Ruto is dressed in a dark brown suit, white shirt, and dark red tie. He's smiling widely at the camera. Odinga is kind of smiling, but not toothily so. Both have either shaved heads or very, very closely cropped hair. They're standing in front of panels of draperies, red and white, with the black, white, red and green flags next to President Ruto. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.